without ever defining them. There are several types of information that have precise mathematical definitions. Any scientific discussion of information, therefore, must be careful to identify which type of information is being discussed at any time. By using vague and inconsistent definitions, it can be made to seem as if there is a conflict where none exists. Acupuncture proponents often use an inconsistent definition of the term, quote, acupuncture. Generally, acupuncture refers to the sticking of thin needles into acupuncture points to elicit an alleged therapeutic effect. However, proponents will often use the term to refer to electroacupuncture, which involves electrical stimulation and has its own effects, thereby muddying the waters. When a 2009 study looking at the effectiveness of acupuncture for chronic back pain showed that needle location and even insertion do not affect the outcome, there was no difference between real acupuncture and placebo acupuncture, the authors claimed that acupuncture worked, it was just unclear by what mechanism. They essentially expanded the definition of acupuncture to include poking the skin randomly with toothpicks. Naturalistic fallacy. The naturalistic fallacy refers to the is-ought problem, confusing what is true with what ought to be true. This is not to be confused with the appeal to nature fallacy, discussed at length in Chapter 14, which posits that being natural is in itself a virtue and anything natural is inherently superior to anything artificial. The naturalistic fallacy usually involves moral judgments. For instance, one might refer to the behavior of animals to justify a particular human behavior as natural. Animals kill each other, therefore it is moral for humans to kill each other. Moral judgments, though, are distinct from what happens to exist in nature. The whole point of ethics is to derive a fair system that allows humans to get along with one another in society. It doesn't matter what strategy specific animals, who do not have an ethical philosophy, evolved to survive. This doesn't mean we can't use the natural world to inform our moral reasoning. It just doesn't determine what is moral. Nirvana fallacy. A familiar phrase that captures the essence of the Nirvana fallacy is that the perfect is the enemy of the good. Essentially, this style of argument starts with the premise that something is not perfect and concludes that it is therefore worthless. Vaccines don't work 100%, therefore they are not useful. Science is flawed, therefore we don't really know anything. Another version of this fallacy is to argue that something doesn't work in a way or accomplish a goal that was never intended in the first place. For example, creationists have argued that natural selection doesn't increase variability, it only reduces it. That is true, but irrelevant. Mutations and recombination increase variability. And then selection provides an adaptive force. These types of arguments are the equivalent of saying that the steering wheel of a car is useless because it cannot accelerate or slow down the vehicle. No true Scotsman. The name of this fallacy comes from the traditional illustrative example. The argument is made that all Scotsmen are brave, and when a counterexample of a cowardly Scotsman is provided, the original claim is defended by saying, well then, he's no true Scotsman. In essence, this fallacy consists of making an argument true by arbitrarily altering the definition of a key term so that the argument is true by definition. It can therefore be considered a special case of the circular reasoning fallacy. Another illustration might be if someone argued that all swans are white. When the example of black swans is raised, the person declares that black swans are not real swans because swans are white. Reductio ad absurdum. In formal logic, the reductio ad absurdum, literally reduction to the absurd, is a legitimate argument. It follows the form that if the premises are assumed to be true, logic necessarily leads to an absurd, false conclusion, and therefore one or more premises must be false. The term is now often used to refer to the abuse of this style of argument, when the logic is deliberately stretched in order to force an absurd conclusion. For example, a UFO enthusiast once argued that if I am skeptical about the existence of alien visitors, I must also be skeptical of the existence of the Great Wall of China, since I have not personally seen either. This is a false reductio ad absurdum, because he is ignoring evidence other than personal eyewitness evidence, and also logical inference. In short, being skeptical of UFOs does not require rejecting the existence of the Great Wall. Slippery slope. This logical fallacy is the argument that a position is not consistent or tenable because accepting the position means that the extreme of the position must also be accepted. But moderate positions do not necessarily lead down the slippery slope to the extreme. This is common in politics. For example, some opponents of embryonic stem cell research have argued that allowing the use of human embryos in research, even those created for IVF that would otherwise be discarded, would inevitably lead to creating embryos specifically for research, a black market in human embryos, or even the forcible extraction of eggs from women for such research. Straw man. A straw man argument is one in which you construct a weak version of someone else's position so that it's an easier target for you to knock down. This is the opposite of the principle of charity, in which the strongest version of an opposing position is assumed. Often, positions that no one actually holds are argued against. This can make it seem as if you have vanquished any objections to your own position, or it can be used to make the opposing side seem silly or easily refuted. Some creationists argue that, because the eye must have evolved, the theory of evolution requires that humans must have had an ancestor with a non-functioning half-eye. Of course, no scientist believes this. Rather, there is a plausible sequence of simpler but fully functioning eyes with many examples from extant species. The opening comment again provides a nice example. They characterized my position with this satire. Clearly, the Mayo Clinic is run by a bunch of quacks and charlatans that have no interest in the health and well-being of the public. How dare they even consider something other than surgery or prescription medication to help people heal? But of course I do not believe this, nor have I ever argued it. What I actually stated was that the Mayo Clinic, and in fact many academic medical centers, have a blind spot when it comes to unconventional treatments, because they lack expertise in the specific treatments and in pseudoscience in general. There is also the common straw man that mainstream doctors only advocate drugs and surgery, when in fact we employ nutrition, physical therapy, lifestyle changes, and other interventions as part of standard care. By attacking a straw man, one may feel better in the moment, but it accomplishes nothing. Tautology. A tautology is an argument that utilizes circular reasoning, which means that the conclusion is also its own premise. The structure of such arguments is A equals B, therefore A equals B, although the premise and conclusion might be formulated differently so the tautology is not immediately apparent. For example, saying that therapeutic touch works because it manipulates the life force is a tautology because the definition of therapeutic touch is the alleged manipulation, without touching, of the life force. This fallacy is often called begging the question, meaning that the premise assumes the conclusion, or that an argument assumes its initial point. Perhaps the most common example is to argue that we know the Bible is the literal word of God because the Bible says so. Sidebar, what's the word? The term begging the question originated in the 16th century. It is a mistranslation of the Latin phrase petitio principii, which actually means to assume the initial point. Because of this mistranslation, the phrase begs the question is now often misused to mean lead to the question. Basically, the phrase is a mess and almost no one uses it correctly, so it's perhaps best to avoid it. Texas sharpshooter fallacy. The name of this fallacy comes from its most common illustrative example. A target shooter claims that he can always hit the bullseye. He aims at the side of a barn, shoots a hole in the wood, and then goes up and draws a target around the hole he just made, giving himself a bullseye. What this analogy refers to is when someone chooses the criteria for success or failure after they know the outcome. It becomes a form of post hoc reasoning, deciding that a certain piece of evidence is evidence for the conclusion you desire, but you decide that only after you know what the evidence is. In order for the evidence to be useful as a support for the conclusion, however, you would have to have determined the criteria for success ahead of time based on valid principles. Conspiracy theories make generous use of this fallacy. For example, some 9/11 conspiracy theories point to the size of the hole made by the plane that crashed into the side of the Pentagon as evidence for a conspiracy. They argue that if a jet truly hit the side of the Pentagon, the hole should be bigger. But there is no prior reason to conclude this. It's not as if we know what size hole a jet crashing into the Pentagon should make. Conspiracy theorists decide after they saw the hole that it was too small and therefore evidence for their conspiracy. This can be a very subtle fallacy, one that essentially can occur any time we reason backward from known outcomes. The moving goalpost. The moving goalpost is a method of denial that involves arbitrarily moving the criteria for proof or acceptance out of range of whatever evidence currently exists. If new evidence comes to light meeting the prior criteria, the goalpost is pushed back further, keeping it out of range of this new evidence. Sometimes impossible criteria are set up at the start, moving the goalpost impossibly out of range for the purpose of denying an undesirable conclusion. Anti-vaxxers claimed that the MMR vaccine caused autism. When scientific studies shut down that claim, they moved on to thimerosal, a mercury-based preservative in some vaccines, but not in the MMR. They predicted that when thimerosal was removed from standard vaccines in the U.S. in 2002, autism rates would plummet. They didn't. So they claimed that mercury from other sources, like coal factories, made up for this drop in mercury exposure from vaccines. When the evidence did not support that claim, they moved on to aluminum as the cause. Nope. And now they just reference vague toxins. No amount of safety data on vaccines is ever enough. They just keep moving the goalpost. Fallacy. I've said it before, but just because an argument isn't sound doesn't mean the conclusion must be false. I might argue that global warming is real because the sky is blue. That's a non sequitur, making the argument unsound. But it may still happen to be true that global warming is a real phenomenon. When an argument isn't sound, it simply means the argument does not support the conclusion. The conclusion may be true or false. The fallacy comes from concluding that a claim must be wrong because one argument proposed for it is not valid. The fallacy may also refer to a situation in which someone claims that another person committed a fallacy when they didn't. If I accuse you of using a straw man when you in fact fairly and accurately summarized my position, I would be committing a fallacy. It's easy to fall into this trap because, as I stated, informal fallacies are context-dependent and often require judgment to properly recognize them. When is a reference to the opinions of experts an appeal to authority fallacy? If I point out that someone was convicted of fraud, is that poisoning the well or legitimate information? It's possible to twist almost any argument to make it seem like a fallacy, if that is your goal, rather than simply using the most valid logic possible. In the extreme, I regularly encounter social media thugs who think that if they can somehow portray another person's argument as fallacious, then they have, quote, won. They commit both types of the fallacy, falsely portraying a sound argument as fallacious and then claiming the conclusion must therefore be wrong. Applying logic every day. Once I learned about common logical fallacies, I started to notice them everywhere. This makes you a big hit at parties. Ahem. This is partly the Bader-Meinhof phenomenon. Once you stumble upon an obscure word or fact, you encounter it again and again, seemingly against the odds. This is part simple coincidence, but also part perception bias. You've likely encountered the word or fact before, but you just didn't notice it. When you become familiar with the common informal logical fallacies, you will likely encounter them everywhere as well because they are common. You may be tempted to point fallacies out every time you think you hear one. I know my wife just loves it when we're having a heated discussion and I point out her logical fallacies. Primarily, I try to use my knowledge of logic to purge my own thinking of sloppy reasoning. It's difficult, but it's worth the effort. Understanding valid logic is also critical to dissecting all the news, opinions, and claims out there. Thinking without logic is like finding your way in the wilderness without a compass or a map. You will probably go around in circles and not really go to where you want to go. Sidebar: name that logical fallacy. In a comment to a blog post I wrote detailing a negative study of ESP, one ESP proponent wrote, at Stephen Novella, "Psi has been experienced by human beings throughout history and across all cultures. Our modern Western culture is virtually unique in rejecting it. You've maintained a position contrary to the collective experience of humankind. You need, therefore, to advance some reasons for supposing it doesn't exist, not merely content yourself with criticizing the research." How many logical fallacies can you point out in that brief statement? I see an unstated major premise, an appeal to popularity and antiquity, and an attempt at shifting the burden of proof. Chapter 11. Skeptic's Guide Entry, Cognitive Biases and Heuristics. Cognitive biases are flaws in the way our brains process information. Heuristics are similar. They're rules of thumb or mental shortcuts that are not reliably true and therefore also lead to biased thinking. The confidence people have in their beliefs is not a measure of the quality of evidence, but of the coherence of the story the mind has managed to construct. Daniel Kahneman. The reality is, we are not Vulcans, with mental constructs and processes of pure logic. Our thinking is too easily influenced by biases and superficial factors, such as how information is presented. Not just casinos, as mentioned in the opening of this section, but the entire marketing industry is based on the fact that people often make irrational decisions for emotional or quirky reasons they don't necessarily understand. Cognitive flaws and biases can be mitigated by metacognition, which is, simply put, thinking about thinking. Skepticism is largely a systematic effort in metacognition, which means understanding how we think and avoiding common mental pitfalls. The human mind is like a sailboat on a sea with strong currents and a steady wind. We tend to just follow the currents of our biases and can easily be manipulated and blown about. Metacognition allows you to grab the rudder, to work the sails and head towards reliable conclusions, even against the current and into the wind. In the previous chapter, we discussed logical fallacies, arguments that involve invalid logic. In this one, we'll look at two further types of flawed thinking, biases and heuristics. They're actually very similar, two sides of the same coin. A cognitive bias is a tendency to think in a certain way, to favor certain kinds of information, and to prefer some conclusions over others. Biases generally deviate your thinking away from reality. Heuristics are mental shortcuts. They are rules of thumb that allow you to approximate a likely answer quickly, but they're not strictly true and often result in error. Heuristics may be helpful and may lead to the correct conclusion, but they are oversimplified. A flawed heuristic may result in a cognitive bias, and a cognitive bias may adversely affect a heuristic. Either way, you can think of these related phenomena as patterns of thinking that are biased or limited. They are currents in the sea of your thoughts. Being aware of them will help you take the helm of your own thinking. Cognitive biases. Have you ever wondered, does it really matter if an item is priced at $19.99 instead of $20? The answer is yes, as ridiculous as that may seem when you examine it. One penny should not make a difference, but we have a leftmost digit bias. We're mainly influenced by the leftmost digit in any number. This likely comes from the tendency to deal with information overload by simplifying it. We tend to focus on the leftmost digit to give us a quick sense of how large the number is. Generally speaking, this isn't a bad rule, but it's easily exploited by using an unlikely but deliberate price ending in all nines. Then there's handedness bias, which is a great example of how we often make decisions below the level of conscious awareness. When offered two equivalent choices, meaning there was no reason why the subject should prefer one choice over the other, right-handed subjects in a study were more likely to choose the option on the right, while left-handers were more likely to choose the option on the left. If a right-handed person had an injured right hand, their choice shifted to the left option. This may reflect a deep aspect of our thinking called embodied cognition. We tend to understand the world in terms of physical relationships, which we then extrapolate to more abstract thinking. For example, we say that your boss is above you hierarchically. They're not physically above you, but we use this spatial analogy. An argument might be said to be weak or strong, or if it's especially bad, we might even call it lame. You are blind to reality and deaf to the concerns of others. A theory can be beautiful, and an idea can be big. We use physical terms to describe and therefore think about abstract concepts that have no physicality. Another important and pervasive bias is the framing bias. Your thinking about something can be dramatically affected simply by how it is presented to you. For example, what if a doctor told you that a procedure has a 10% death rate? And what if they told you it had a 90% survival rate? These are obviously identical, but people react very differently to the framing. Far more people will opt for a procedure that has a 90% survival rate than one presented with a 10% death rate. Another example is a survey showing that 62% of people disagreed with allowing public condemnation of democracy, but only 46% of people agreed that it was right to forbid public condemnation of democracy. These are, again, the same outcome. Part of the reason for the difference is how we think about risk. Humans tend to be risk-averse when it comes to positive outcomes and risk-seeking when it comes to negative outcomes. We don't like to miss out on a positive outcome, and so we'll take the sure thing. We will take a guarantee of $100 rather than a 50% chance of getting $200. However, we are willing to take a bigger risk in order to avoid a negative outcome. Patients with terminal illness, therefore, will take big risks with fanciful and unlikely treatments. Related to our risk assessment biases is the gambler's fallacy. If you flip a fair coin heads 5 times in a row, most people will feel that tails is now due. The bias is in thinking that past events influence future events, even when there is no causal connection. Since each coin flip is independent, it does not matter what happened before. The chance of another heads is still 50%. Casinos love this bias because it gives people the illusion that they can predict the next throw of the dice or the next outcome on a roulette table. Red is due, so let's bet it all. We are also biased by our basic psychology, which caters to our emotional needs. We need to feel we are part of a group where we are liked and accepted. Thus, there is an in-group bias. We are biased towards our group, making much more favorable judgments of our in-group than an out-group. Similarly, we are hugely biased towards ourselves. We will give ourselves every benefit of the doubt and interpret our own actions in the most favorable light. We're also motivated to minimize cognitive dissonance, that uncomfortable feeling we discussed in Chapter 9, which occurs when facts conflict with each other or with our desires. If we purchase an item, our assessment of the quality of that item goes up. We're trying to justify the purchase to ourselves. In fact, if we are given multiple items to choose from, and then we discover our first choice is not available, we are likely to jump over our second choice and go for number 3. This makes no sense, so why would anyone do this? It is likely because we already had to reject our second choice in favor of the first. Once we choose, we have to justify the choice by downgrading the quality of choice 2. Therefore, number 2 is now worse than number 3, which we then prefer. Crazy, right? Silly humans. We also tend to assume that other people think like we do, a phenomenon called the projection bias. This is the way we think about and understand what other people are likely thinking. We tend to use our own mind as a template to make predictions about how other people will think and act. So if something bothers us, we assume it bothers other people as well. This is closely related to the consensus bias. We tend to assume that our own opinions are in the majority, that most other people share them. At a friendly get-together, a distant relative of mine was shocked to find that my friend was a Republican. This relative laughed at themselves when they realized they just assumed everyone they met was a Democrat like them. In their mind, Republicans weren't real people they could run into at a party. Hindsight bias can be a squirrely one. Once we know the outcome of a situation, that knowledge colors our interpretation of what happened and why. We tend to think that whatever happened was inevitable, destined to happen, even if it was a close call. Think about the news coverage of any recent presidential election. Once we know which candidate won, the pundits are happy to explain why this outcome was obvious. The losing candidate never had a chance. Our thinking about evolution is also plagued by the hindsight bias. How often have you heard that dinosaurs were doomed to extinction because of some flaw or weakness? Mammals were clearly destined to dominate the world. Remember the movie Ice Age? The dodo bird was depicted as hopelessly defenseless and stupid, even suicidal. The fact of its extinction is apparently sufficient evidence for this. Hindsight bias is similar to post hoc reasoning. Once we know the outcome, we are really good at inventing reasons to explain it. Perhaps the biggest cognitive bias of them all is the confirmation bias. This bias is so significant, we gave it its own chapter, which is how you know it's significant, right? Heuristics. Heuristics are a form of cognitive bias, but they serve a purpose and can be semi-useful. I tend to think of them as 90% rules. If someone calls me on the phone with a story that ends with them needing my credit card number, I assume it's a scam. I know it may not be, but it's a useful rule. Or if you always assume a situation is more complicated than you think, you will be right most of the time. The key is to be aware of what rules you are using and recognize that they're not always applicable. Some unconscious shortcuts are biased and may be more misleading than useful. The availability heuristic, for example, is the unstated assumption that if we can easily call an example of something to mind, it must therefore be common or important. If you can think of an instance when somebody who worked at the DMV was rude, you will likely think that such behavior is typical. If you know someone who was mugged in New York City, you think muggings are common in the Big Apple. Of course, neither of these conclusions is necessarily true. Your own anecdotes are just that. They are quirky and not representative. We know intellectually that we need systematic statistical data to make judgments about how common something is. But we leap to conclusions anyway, based on the mental availability of an example. A common heuristic with a statistical theme is the representativeness heuristic. We tend to think that someone or something likely belongs to a category if they have features typical of that category. While there is some truth to this, we overapply the rule and ignore two other critical pieces of information. First is the base rate. How common is that category? If the category is rare, then the probability of someone belonging to that category may still be low, even if they are typical for it. The second is predictive value. A feature may be typical of a category, but not specific to it. Sherlock Holmes famously used the example of the clopping of hooves to explain this principle to Watson. If you hear the clopping of hooves behind you on the streets of London, think horse, not zebra. This example has been borrowed by the medical culture. When medical students suggest a rare diagnosis, it's a zebra. Let's say a patient has palpitations, headaches, sweating, and high blood pressure. These are all symptoms that are very typical of a condition known as pheochromocytoma, a tumor that secretes adrenaline. However, pheos are extremely rare. Therefore, even with typical symptoms, the patient is far more likely to have anxiety or hyperthyroidism or pretty much anything else that can cause these symptoms. Pheos are that rare. An inexperienced medical student, however, will follow the representativeness heuristic and suggest this diagnosis. Their experienced mentors will then chuckle, mutter something about zebras, and explain how damn rare pheos are. Oh, sure, we'll still do the lab test to make certain, but no one will hold their breath. In other words, having high blood pressure is not very predictive of having pheo, because it is not very specific to that one condition. Lots of people have high blood pressure and don't have this rare condition. To take a more general example, and also the one Kahneman used when describing the representativeness heuristic, let's say that John is a computer nerd who likes to keep to himself and obsesses over tiny details. If John goes to made-up university, what are the odds that he is an engineering major rather than a humanities major? You might be tempted to say it is more likely he is an engineering major, but you can't know that and therefore may be wrong. What if 99% of the students at made-up U are humanities majors and only 1% are engineering majors? It is then more likely that John is an atypical humanities major than a typical engineering major, the validity of such stereotypes aside. Here is a simpler heuristic, the unit bias. It derives from a desire to simplify a complex world to make some reasonable first approximations that aren't always accurate. We tend to focus on one salient feature of an item or thing and use that feature as the one measure of value, quality, or quantity. In a 2009 study by Andrew Geer and Paul Rosen, they asked people to estimate the weight of others. They found that people relied solely on girth while ignoring height, which led to significant inaccuracies. The unit bias is also very common in the marketing of technology. Remember computer buying in the 90s and early aughts? Everything was about the speed in megahertz of the processor, as if that one number captured the overall power of the system. Other details like RAM, the motherboard, or the chipset were too complex for the average computer buyer to worry about, so they focused on chip speed. The same is basically true of digital cameras. It's all about the megapixels. Meanwhile, maximum resolution in megapixels is perhaps one of the least important details for most users. You're better off worrying about the quality of the lens. I see you, techno nerds, sweating the details of these examples. The point is, most people boil down the complex features of these technologies to a single number. Finally, we come to the anchoring heuristic. This one is also common in marketing. Let's say I show you a house and then ask you if you think the house is worth more or less than $100,000. I then ask you what you think the house is worth. I ask another person if they think the same house is worth more or less than $500,000, and then I ask them to guess the price. The person who was anchored to the $100,000 reference will guess significantly lower than the person who was anchored to the $500,000 price, even though they're assessing the same house. Yes, we are that easy to manipulate. That's why commercials say, "Would you be willing to pay $100 for this fabulous product? How about $200? Well, now you can get it for the ridiculously low price of $19.95. This is why psychologists suggest that in a negotiation, you should make the opening bid, to anchor all further bidding. Anchoring goes beyond money as well. We also anchor things in time or place, and we anchor value judgments. So, can you really beat the odds at Las Vegas? No. The math is against you. And any belief that you can beat the math is based on cognitive biases, happily encouraged by the casinos. Unless you use an actual analytical process like card counting, which is considered cheating. Next time you see a commercial or watch the news, or simply chat with friends, try to get into the metacognition zone. How are you processing and evaluating information? How are your judgments biased? How are you being psychologically manipulated? Grab control of that rudder and go against the currents. Chapter 12. Skeptic's Guide Entry, Confirmation Bias. Confirmation bias is the tendency of individuals to seek out or interpret new information as support for previously held notions or beliefs, even when such interpretations don't hold up to statistical scrutiny. If an athlete wears a particular pair of socks to each game because he believes it will improve his chances of winning, He may remember the times he won wearing those socks, but forget the times he won wearing different socks or the times he lost wearing the so-called special socks. Ever since I first learned about confirmation bias, I've been seeing it everywhere. John Ronson. We love to get feedback from our listeners, but a few years ago, one SGU listener emailed to complain that a segment we were running at the time, This Week in Skepticism, was clearly biased towards women, likely as part of some feminist agenda. That sounded like a factual claim, so I quickly tallied up the 100 or so installments of that segment and found that the segment focused on a woman 15% of the time, on a man 45% of the time, and did not focus on an individual 40% of the time. I thanked the listener for pointing this out and vowed we would spend more time focusing on female scientists and skeptics. How is it that this listener's perception was so at odds with the clear reality, and over something that mere counting could resolve? The answer is confirmation bias. Confirmation bias is perhaps the most powerful and pervasive cognitive bias, which is why it gets its own chapter, and it's important to understand it thoroughly. Confirmation bias is the one bias to rule all biases, the mayor of Biastown, captain of the USS Bias, the Sith Lord of the bias side of the Force. Okay, you get the idea. Confirmation bias is a tendency to notice, accept, and remember information that appears to support an existing belief and to ignore, distort, explain away, or forget information that seems to contradict an existing belief. This process works undetected in the background of our minds to create the powerful illusion that the facts support our beliefs. In an effort to make sense of all the information we encounter, we produce a specific worldview, a framework, narrative, or paradigm, as it were. Having an organizing and explanatory system for all the information we deal with is helpful, even necessary. But these processes can take on a life of their own. The narratives we use to understand the world don't just organize information, they curate and filter it to serve those very narratives. Don't get me wrong, it's not as if we intend to manipulate the facts or to rewrite history. Confirmation bias is often subtle and nuanced, and because of this, it's especially pernicious. We talked previously about motivated reasoning, see Chapter 9, which is more of a conscious process to protect our cherished beliefs. Confirmation bias is a more unconscious bias. This error in our thinking is constantly working in the background to undermine the rational process. It's lurking within us, and we must always be on the lookout. Consider this scenario. The leaves outside have begun to change color. You're swapping your t-shirts for sweaters. A chorus of coughing has begun to resonate throughout the halls of the office. It's flu season. Time for a quick trip to the pharmacy to get the annual flu vaccine. But years ago, you stopped getting flu shots because you remember feeling really crummy the day after you got one. Your throat was a little raw, your nose got stuffy, and you had joint pain for half a week. Based on this anecdote, you concluded that the flu vaccine made you sick and wasn't worth it. This conclusion then became a filter through which you saw the world. Later, your mom told you about her cousin's husband who broke out in a fever following his flu shot, forcing him to stay home from work. You remember this story, maybe even tweaking it in your memory. Didn't he also have a rash? Because it confirms your belief. You see a report on the news that the flu vaccine is not a good match to that year's circulating virus and therefore not that effective. That one's a keeper. The next year, when the flu vaccine was a good match and particularly effective, you didn't notice, or you considered that to be an exception. You go out to dinner with some of your friends, and the conversation turns to the season. Some of them recount how they always get vaccinated and rarely get the flu. Others tell of getting the flu despite the vaccine, or even getting side effects from the vaccine. Guess which stories you remember? Relying on your subjective perception isn't only unreliable, it's biased by your existing beliefs. To find out if the flu vaccine really is worthwhile, you need to look at objective numbers. Each year, only about 0.0001% of people who get the vaccine have a severe allergic reaction. That's one person per million doses. And there's no way of knowing how many people contract the flu before the vaccine has reached its peak effectiveness. Influenza can incubate for up to 4 days, and the flu shot isn't fully effective until 2 full weeks after administration. You probably have connections to a vast network of people, once you count second and third degrees of separation. It's likely that someone in that group, larger than you probably think, had a reaction to the vaccine or contracted the flu after getting the vaccine, but before immunity kicked in. But significantly more people get vaccinated, and because of the protection this affords them, they don't get the flu. In the U.S. alone, the Centers for Disease Control, CDC, reports that between 2005 and 2014, the flu vaccine prevented the deaths of more than 40,000 people. Flu vaccines work when you look at statistics and large numbers, but casually skimming your everyday experiences might not reflect that. Here's another example, this one from psychologist Thomas Gilovich. A husband believes he always puts down the toilet seat. His wife, with whom he shares a bathroom, believes he never puts down the seat. They are working from the exact same set of data, but arrive at opposite conclusions. Why? Well, the husband notices when he remembers to put down the seat. The wife notices when he doesn't. He doesn't notice when he forgets, because that's what it means to forget. She doesn't notice when he does, because it's a non-event. When referring to psychics, we call this remembering the hits and forgetting the misses. A psychic will throw out all sorts of statements, and the client is likely to remember only the ones that stand out for being accurate. Confirmation bias works even more subtly in our everyday lives. We may have a narrative that blue-eyed people are rude. Whenever someone is rude to you, you may look to see what color eyes they have. If they have blue eyes, this confirms your narrative, and you remember it as evidence to support it. If they do not have blue eyes, you dismiss that information as an exception and promptly forget the encounter. This is often how bigotry is formed and maintained. The very concept of an exception implies a conclusion. It's not an exception. It's data. Data that are as valid as the instances that appear to support your narrative. But we subconsciously treat confirming instances as data and disconfirming instances as exceptions. Or we may make a specific excuse such as, the brown-eyed person wasn't that rude, or perhaps they were provoked in a way that would make anyone rude. The information is rationalized away, and we eventually forget it. The blue-eyed person who is rude to you, however, is a story that lives forever, proving your narrative. When I was working as an intern in the emergency room on a particularly busy night, a nurse noted how frantic the ER was. She then commented to the room, "It's a zoo here tonight. Is there a full moon out?" The answer was no, no full moon. She responded with a shrug and went about her business. To her, that was an uninteresting non-event. But if there had by chance been a full moon, that would have powerfully confirmed her prior belief that the ER is busier under maximum lunar influences. This is why confirmation bias has such a strong effect. It gives us the confident illusion that we are following the evidence. In reality, our beliefs are manufacturing the evidence. In the end, we may be extremely confident in a totally false belief. Confirmation bias works with many other biases and processes in a synergistic way. There is so much information out there in the world. We encounter numerous events, people, and bits of data every day. Our brains are great at sifting this data for meaningful patterns. And when we see one, we think, what are the odds? That cannot be a coincidence, so it confirms my belief. Rather, the odds are very good. The possibility that you would encounter something confirming your belief was almost certain, given the number of opportunities. In this way, confirmation bias dovetails with data mining and pattern recognition. Another factor that plays into confirmation bias is the use of open-ended criteria, like ad hoc or post hoc analysis. We often decide after we encounter a bit of information that this information confirms our belief, and we retrofit the new data into our belief as confirmation. We may call this subjective validation, the tendency to use subjective criteria to validate our prior beliefs. There's a closely related bias called desirability bias. We are biased toward information that supports what we want to be true, even if we don't already believe it. In a 2016 study conducted just prior to the presidential election, Ben Tappan and his fellow psychologists asked subjects which candidate they preferred and which candidate they thought would win. They were then presented with new polling data favoring one candidate or the other. The people surveyed were much more predisposed to accepting polling data that favored the candidate they wanted to win rather than the candidate they believed would win. Confirming their desires was more powerful than confirming their beliefs. What this study suggests is how complex human thinking is, and therefore how difficult to study. I don't think we can make any general statements about how people treat beliefs. Psychologically, there are different kinds of beliefs. People treat emotionally held beliefs differently from emotionally neutral beliefs. We happily update the latter when we receive new information, but we cling tightly to the former and may even tighten our grip in the face of disconfirming information, a backfire effect. Our emotions trigger motivated reasoning in some cases, but not others. So, in the polling study, some of the subjects may have held the belief that their candidate would win as an emotional belief. Fewer people probably had an emotional attachment to the belief that their candidate would lose. As new data came in, people would cling to the notion that their candidate would win, but not to the idea that they would lose. But even this conclusion is too simple. If you recall, Donald Trump was claiming that the election was rigged. It's therefore possible that some Trump supporters believed Hillary Clinton would win because the election would be rigged. When new polling showed Trump might actually win, they could easily shift to the conclusion that Trump was popular enough to win even a rigged election. People can change their opinion in the face of overwhelming evidence, however, if it's sufficient to overcome their motivated reasoning. I've engaged many times with people who deny global warming. When confronted with the solid evidence that the Earth is in fact warming, some deniers will still cling to denial that the warming is real, but others will retreat to the position that even though the Earth may be warming, we don't know if humans are causing it. Or, even if we know humans are causing it, we don't know that the consequences will be bad. Or even if the consequences will be bad, there is nothing we could do about it. These softer positions, however, are held reluctantly. And although they may now technically constitute prior beliefs, I doubt that confirmation bias would support them. Rather, the denier will still jump on any evidence that seems to support what they want to believe and will quickly revert to the belief that global warming is not even happening when given the chance. I think that desirability bias and confirmation bias are two sides of the same coin and are not easily disentangled. In reality, there will often be a complex web of competing beliefs and desires. Furthermore, not all beliefs are the same, and there is a spectrum of emotional and identity implications for specific beliefs. Further still, in this study, they were asking for people's predictions about what would happen, which may also introduce new biases, such as a potential optimist or pessimist bias. The following comments come from one practitioner of a medical forum dedicated to body asymmetry disorders as an explanation for chronic conditions such as multiple sclerosis and chronic fatigue syndrome. See if you can spot confirmation bias at work. I personally have serious doubts if there is anything like MS or MS being an autoimmune disease. Literally everyone I have seen and treated with MS was actually a TMJ, temporal mandibular joint, dysfunction patient. I am anxiously looking for my first real MS patient. I am currently treating at least 20 MS patients. Many of them have had short-lived benefits from CCSVI, chronic cerebrospinal venous insufficiency. They all appear to be substantially improving with TMJ correction, and most symptoms previously labeled MS-related have disappeared. I believe that most MS lesions are a consequence of CSF, cerebrospinal fluid, leaking into the brain stroma. They are not lesions in the neural tissue as such, otherwise the symptoms would persist. Imagine taking a slice of pathological tissue around any infective lesion. One is bound to see an increased immune function. To go on to interpret it as an autoimmune disease would be pure folly. The immune system needs help, not an assault on its function, which the drugs do. I remain to be corrected on my hypothesis. Sounds pretty confident. It's also all utter nonsense. The commenter, a practitioner of dental therapy, is arguing that multiple sclerosis and some other diseases don't really exist and are just jaw and tooth problems. Meanwhile, we have over 5 decades of research telling us that multiple sclerosis, MS, is an autoimmune disease. The result of the immune system attacking one's own tissue, in the case of MS, the brain and spinal cord. There are literally thousands of published studies supporting this conclusion, with multiple independent lines of evidence. The commenter, who clearly knows very little about immunology or autoimmune disease, tries to dismiss some of this evidence, such as that from biopsy or autopsy examination. He argues that seeing inflammation around MS lesions in the brain doesn't prove the lesion is autoimmune. It could just be the immune system doing its job. Whenever you hear a claim like this about a mature science, you have to ask yourself, so all the researchers dedicated to this discipline over decades missed this simple idea? If something apparently obvious occurs to you as a non-expert, it's a good bet that it has occurred to people who have spent their careers researching the issue. The difference between reactive immune activity and autoimmune activity is a basic concept. It's thought of every time a pathologist looks at immune activity on a slide and wonders, is this reactive immunity or a primary inflammatory lesion? MS is an autoimmune disease. There is evidence of chronic central nervous system immune activity. Lesions are inflammatory, and immunosuppressant treatment works. The commenter claims they never met a real MS patient. What are their criteria? Are typical brain lesions and inflammatory markers not enough? He implies that if someone who is diagnosed with MS shows improvement in any of their symptoms with TMJ correction, then they don't have MS. He doesn't seem to be aware of the illusory power of placebo effects. Any treatment, if looked at in an open-ended way, will seem to work for almost any condition. That's the power of confirmation bias. Only by carefully studying a treatment in a blinded fashion to eliminate the effect of all biases can we get reliable information about the real effects of the treatment. What published research is there to support the claims of this commenter? Very little. A couple of pilot studies, meaning preliminary type studies that are not blinded, controlled, or otherwise rigorous. Preliminary studies themselves are little more than confirmation bias. They have a huge positive bias and are likely to support the researcher's hypothesis. They are not confirmatory, meaning they really aren't evidence at all, but just an exploration to guide later research. The commenter is further impressed by the fact that he can speculate wildly about an explanation for apparent MS lesions. This is just another form of confirmation bias. We believe that because we can think of an explanation, this in itself is a sort of confirmation. The entire field of astrology is based upon this process. We tend to underestimate our own creativity and ability to invent explanations for things post hoc. The aptitude to do so says absolutely nothing about the viability of our beliefs, because we can invent post hoc explanations for anything. The real question is there any objective evidence for the hypothesis? In this case, the answer is no. Confirmation bias also works hand in hand with our tendency to look specifically for evidence that confirms, rather than disconfirms, our beliefs. Even when specifically testing a hypothesis or claim, we tend to frame our tests in a way designed to confirm the hypothesis. If we think classical music will make plants grow, we might test this idea by playing music for our plants and seeing how well they grow. You should be thinking, but wait, we need a control not exposed to classical music. You need some basis of comparison to know what effect the music is having. The notion of a control group comes from scientific thinking and is not intuitive. Less obvious is the toupee fallacy. Some people believe they can always tell when someone is wearing a toupee. You can substitute many things for this, breast implants, contact lenses, if they're lying, etc. Confirmation of this belief comes from all the times when someone was wearing a toupee and they noticed. But here's the thing. They are, by definition, not aware of cases in which someone had a toupee and they didn't notice. Also, unless they went up to every person they identified as a toupee wearer, and asked if they indeed had a toupee or pulled their hair, they don't know if they had any false positives. Unless they systematically tested their ability to identify toupees, they really have no idea how good they are at such detection. Let's say you make the observation that people who drive sports cars are more likely to have cats as pets. In order to test your hypothesis, you randomly ask people you encounter with sports cars if they own a pet and what type. You then tally up how many sports car owners have cats. You might think you have tested your hypothesis, but you haven't. You have only looked to confirm your hypothesis. You also have to ask people who don't own sports cars to see what pets they own, if any. The power of confirmation bias is that it works tirelessly in the background, filtering vast amounts of data until you have a compelling illusion that the evidence supports your belief. In a way, your own brain is gaslighting you, convincing you that reality is different than it actually is and giving you false confidence. It can be incredibly difficult to shake a belief that is supported by a huge construct of confirmation bias. Doing so would involve admitting that you can be profoundly wrong about something that you are sure is correct because you've just seen too much evidence in its favor. It can be unsettling to realize how vulnerable we are to such biases, but that's a humbling and necessary step towards critical thinking. Sidebar: Wason selection task. One of the pitfalls of learning about critical thinking and pseudoscience is that your confidence can easily turn into cockiness. It's important to remember that knowing about cognitive biases doesn't make you immune to them. After listening to this audiobook, you won't be magically protected from error or bias. You won't be able to assert your opinions as if they are the authoritative truth. The metacognitive skills we discuss are tools. It takes vigilance and a lifetime of practice and reflection to put them to use. Doing this will help you minimize your flaws and biases, but you can never be rid of them. Here's a fun task that, for some of you at least, will demonstrate that understanding metacognition is not necessarily enough to avoid making mental errors. The task is this. There are four cards on the table before you. They each have a letter on one side and a number on the other. I have a hypothesis. Every card that has a vowel on one side has an even number on the other side. The four cards are showing A, 7, D, and 4. The question for you is this. Which cards do I need to flip over in order to test my hypothesis? Go ahead and decide before listening ahead for the answer. This was a psychological study performed by P.C. Wason in 1966. In his original study, only 10% of subjects got the right answer, which means they turned over all the cards they needed to and none of the cards they did not need to. Later replications yielded similar results. The correct answer is that you need to turn over A and 7, but not D or 4. The reason is these are the two cards that can falsify your hypothesis. If A doesn't have an even number on the other side, or 7 has a vowel, the hypothesis is wrong. D and 4 are irrelevant because they cannot test your rule. Most people will turn over 4 to see if there's a vowel on the other side, but this will still not prove the rule, and the 4 can't falsify the rule because it's okay to have an even number opposite a consonant. Instinctively, however, people look for evidence to confirm their hypothesis rather than evidence that can disprove it. An interesting wrinkle to the Wason selection task is that the results differ depending on context. If, for example, one side of the cards has ages and the other what someone is drinking, people have no problem figuring out if there is any underage drinking going on. Our instincts are better suited to social interactions than abstract problems, apparently. But the core lesson remains, if you want to test your hypothesis, try to prove it wrong. Do not only look for evidence to prove it right. Chapter 13. Skeptic's Guide Entry, Appeal to Antiquity. The appeal to antiquity is a special form of the appeal to authority fallacy. In this case, the alleged authority is the assumption of ancient wisdom, or the notion that an idea that has stood the test of time must be valid. It is not the antiquity of a tale that is an evidence